From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? We've got a guest joining us this week, but we also have all three of us on deck. Myself, locked down here in the Cayman Islands. Roger, I presume you are where we left you?
Yes, yes, although closer to the golf course now that we've had relaxation of the rules.
Attaboy. Good for you. I'm not jealous much. And docking, presumably in West London somewhere, is the captain himself, Charles Morgan.
Yeah, I'm still very much in Wandsworth and, not going anywhere. I'm just giving up my golf course membership as well, so don't know what that means.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's bad timing, but I just...
I was reading that some guy in New Zealand who was posting on Twitter saying that there were golf course memberships that were going for like $175,000 a few years ago that they're trying to offload for like 10 and 15 now because the golf memberships have just collapsed. Not, and this is just, it's Corona. This is Roger's point, generational, that the golf industry is going to go through a really hard time. It's definitely starting to happen. So Charles, you are giving it a swift kick in the todger when it's down.
Well, only because I'm so bad.
Well, I mean, that means you're at the course longer. That's more time that you can put money over the bar.
To be fair, I've maintained a membership status where I'm allowed to drink.
Fair enough. That's all that, for you, that's what they want. You're not clutching the bar up. Well, we have a guest joining us this week to talk about something that we've kind of all acknowledged is going to be, if not the next big thing, then one of the next big things, and that's esports. And joining us today, we have one of the leading lights in that part of the sports universe, Tommy Kovalainen, who is one of the senior executives at a company called IGC, which many of you won't have heard of, but they're one of the big players in the esports industry based out in California. Tommy's been a professional gamer when such a thing was a very rare thing to be and significantly underpaid compared to what you can earn today doing it. He's also been an investment banker at JP Morgan, if I'm correct in speaking.
JPM.
Yeah, there you go. So instead of the three of us, nobody's waffling on for any time. Why don't we bring him straight in? Tommy, welcome to Are You Not Entertained? Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, we're going to do things slightly differently this week, if we can, because you've had such an interesting background. You've had a couple of careers at least. And I think the nature of those careers is actually very important to your progression and the progression of the area you're in now. So I'd love you, if you can, to walk us through that journey from your first career to where you are now, so people can get a sense of your background and how you've ended up where you are.
Sure. Just to be clear, I'm not that old. I'm just trying to work through things a little bit faster. So I used to play a lot of sports growing up, and then my sort of, I think it was 14, 15, a couple of my friends got into a game called Counter-Strike, started playing that online. I started playing with them, and I ended up becoming a professional player, one of the early ones back then. And I think I was the second person to get the get an O-1 visa to the U.S. for video games at the time. So I moved to the U.S., played for a team that was later bought by Amazon, which is now, or Twitch rather, which is now obviously owned by Amazon. In 2009, 2010, I played for a couple more years after getting back to Europe. And then kind of decided to get out of actively playing. I was, I think, 24 at the time. So I still had quite a few years left if I wanted to, but I kind of thought that, look, I've kind of seen what there is to playing video games for a living. Obviously, in hindsight, would have been worth a lot more money these days than it was back then. So it turns out there was something right around the corner. But from an experience point of view, I think I kind of got to see all that there was, and I wanted to do something else. So I had already started working on sort of the on many ancillary things at the same time. So I was working for the largest media company that covers Counter-Strike. So we built a site called angeltv.org that sold for about $40 million a couple months ago. I work for a large gaming matchmaking platform called ESEA that was sold to MTG, Modern Times Group, that owns ESL in 2015. And then I had a bunch of other similar roles where I was kind of advising or otherwise helping with many of the companies that were active in the scene. So I was kind of, you know, already trying to transition to the business side of things, which was interesting to me. So when I quit playing, I went to college back home in Finland. I ended up graduating in 2 years. So I got an internship at JP Morgan in London on my second year. So I did that in the spring, graduated in the summer, and then started in 2015 at JPM. Ended up doing around 2.5-3 years of M&A there, worked in healthcare and at the TMT groups. During that time, I also co-founded with some of the people that I knew from the Finnish esports scene, the what is now the most successful Finnish company in esports called NC Sports. Probably one of the 20 largest brands, I would say, nowadays, at least as it pertains to Counter-Strike and the core games that NC is active in. So that's sort of the esports side of things. And then after JPM, I ended up moving to California, where I live now, joined a company called Immortals, nowadays Immortals Gaming Club. We kind of have a different view to different take on esports a little bit, I would say. We kind of view it as not necessarily as becoming a huge cash cow in terms of the esports teams themselves, which is also, by the way, not what traditional sports by and large are. We kind of view it as these are the high affinity brands that we have access to, and then we'd kind of like to monetize them elsewhere here. So
no, but Tommy, let's focus a little bit on something you moved over very quickly there. When you said you played a lot of sports as a kid, before at 15, obviously getting into gaming, what were the traditional things that you were getting involved in? What sports did you follow? I think you're an NBA guy, basketball?
So I turned into an NBA guy later on. Honestly, I used to be a very big hockey guy, as are most people from Finland, which is where I'm from.
Okay,
By far the biggest sport there. Used to play soccer, used to play softball, used to play basically every single sport that was popular among kids where I'm from. Hockey was my biggest sport by far. That's what I enjoyed playing the most, enjoyed watching the most as well. The year that I sort of got out on hockey and never managed to get back in was the year that the Kings won the cup, playing the most boring hockey that's ever existed in the history of the universe. And that's when a couple of my friends were sort of like, hey, you know, not only is the NBA not random, the best players play 95% of the game, so you get more of the best players. And so I sort of started transitioning towards basketball about a decade ago.
So Tommy, let me ask you, because I'm going back. I'm now Roger's opened Pandora's box. I can jump into something at the very beginning of what you talked about there, and that's you know, getting the chance to understand what it was like at the very beginning of something. So for you to become a professional gamer, we're in an industry that was pretty nascent at the time. I mean, there weren't many professional gamers, and the idea, in fact, in kind of mainstream minds that you could be even such a thing was kind of one of those weird and wonderful, oh, this is a fad, it'll never take off. Take us back to that decision and what the professional gaming market was like back in its earlier days.
I don't know that there was much of a market, to be honest. And I think the path towards it kind of reflects that. I think it was more opportunistic from my part. So the way it kind of worked out is, you know, we'd start playing online competitions with my friends. We'd play some tournaments that included everybody from Finland. We'd win some of those tournaments. And then every now and then there would be a qualification tournament. But then we'd qualify for a tournament, say, in, you know, Spain or Brazil or South Korea. So we'd go there. And then once we did well in those, someone would come in and say, like, hey, we'll pay you, you know, what is now pennies for salary, and we'll pay some extra trips for you to go to some other tournaments that you don't necessarily have to qualify for, or you can just pay your way into. And that just sort of kept growing every year. So, you know, we'd do well 1 year, someone else would come in and offer us a little bit more money and more funds to pay for travel, etc. And then it would just kind of gradually grow up. It wasn't like we signed a contract one day and then all of a sudden we were professional players. It's just that it ended up taking so much time. After a couple of years, you know, we might have been traveling, I don't know, 100, 150 days a year. So it just became very hard to do anything else at the same time. So
Tom,
was,
so Sorry, Tommy, just it's Giles here. I want to sort of interrupt you, and I apologize for doing so, because I represent, like a lot of our listeners, old gits, who are people, I've got, you can't see me, but I've got very little hair, and I hobble around from on a cane most of the time. One of the things that I think our listeners would be hugely interested in, particularly as you've talked about this very fast journey that gaming and esports have been on, because it's all relatively new in the last 15, 20 years, really, there was obviously nothing before, is how would you define gaming and how would you define esports now that there's been some time to reflect, as this has now become a multi-billion dollar industry? How would you define the two to someone who's maybe a parent's age who goes, what is this gaming thing? What is this e-sport thing? Because I think definition has been one of the challenges as well as maybe one of the opportunities.
Sure. I mean, the way I kind of think about it is gaming is anything from playing Candy Crush on your phone to, you know, playing competitive video games. Right. And then esports, I would just say, is the sort of competitive version of that. So, you know, if there were a Candy Crush World Championship, which I don't think there is, but if there were, I think that would be esports. The same way, you know, anybody can buy Call of Duty for their console at the store and they can play it and it's gaming. And then if they ended up playing in the Call of Duty League, they would be part of esports.
And Tommy, if you had, thank you, because that helps. And if you had, if you had your time again, I think one of the confusions and confusion often leads to miscommunication, etc., obviously, is, do you think the word esports is the right word? Because it seems to be that they're immediately put into competition, sport versus esport, when actually I don't think, and I've read a lot of your stuff, there isn't natural competition. There are different ways of competing. Do you think that's been one of the problems, just the definition that esport to sound too close to sport, and therefore the traditionalists have said, oh, I say, that sounds very frightening, we can't have that. And esporters are saying, well, we've got our rights and we can do what we like. Do you think definition has been one of the problems?
I think branding-wise, someone, whoever was the first one who came up with the term esports, probably could have done a little bit better. I think nowadays everybody's kind of gotten over that and people don't really care the same way, as far as I can tell. I'm sure some people still do, but I think by and large, it's gotten a lot better over the last couple of years. You'd probably just call it competitive gaming, I think, would be the best way to put it. The problem is it's not as snappy, it's not as quick to write, and it's not as catchy. So I can understand why people would wanna use it. Sort of a shorter term like esports instead. But I agree. I mean, I don't think it's the best term. I think competitive gaming would actually be an ideal way of calling it. But, you know, good luck getting that through to everybody.
Tommy, one of the things that we want to talk about in the limited time that we have with you, we could probably do a whole series of podcasts on this, is because we now have a couple of things, a couple of big trends in traditional sports that are right in the middle of what you're looking at just now. The first one is that traditional sports, the age demographic is, as Giles says, guys like us, you know, 50, white male, and it's getting older and older and older, and everybody in the sports industry thinks that esports, in a very superficial way, will be the answer. The second trend, obviously, is what's happened in the last 2 or 3 months with the virus, where everybody has seen that esports has managed to maintain an engagement with its following, obviously much superior to traditional sports. And everybody's saying, look, we really need to understand how to do this, because they're doing it fine and we don't know what's happening. Help us understand a little bit those two things and where you see the two parallel tracks meeting or not meeting. I think that's what everybody's wrestling with in the traditional sports industry just now.
So I think the demographics piece is a real problem for traditional sports. I obviously wrote about this on the Financial Times' Alphaville last week in an article. Yeah. But I mean, the problem with traditional sports, the way I kind of think of it at least, is that given that so many fewer younger kids nowadays are interested in playing sports, increasingly it's less and less likely that as they grow up, they're going to be super interested in watching other people play those sports. At least from my experience, that tends to be the connection. Now, obviously many of the bigger sports are just cultural. Few people play American football, at least anything actually resembling American football in the US, but it's cultural. So everybody watches it. Same for Super Bowl everywhere. But by and large, I think to the extent that you can fix participation rates in youth sports, I think it's going to be hard to get everybody to be watching in the same numbers in their 40s and 50s and 60s as they grow older, if they don't grow up playing those games and start watching those games when they're young. And that's obviously where gaming is becoming a bit of a problem for sports, in that young kids by and large tend to favor playing video games. I think that's been a problem for many parents, I think, for a couple of decades now. I think it's only getting worse and worse now that everybody has a smartphone. It's a lot harder to police kids playing games. You know, when I was growing up, my parents, they don't want me to play anymore. They would just jack the Ethernet cable, or they'd take the power cord out of the computer. You know, they'd figure out a way. I think nowadays it's all but impossible to do anything like that, frankly. On the second part of the question, I think that one thing that kind of sets gaming and esports apart from traditional sports is just how accessible it is, and then also how much more engaging it can be. What I mean by that is, you know, if you're watching the NFL, watching the NBA, you're by and large you're either at a sports bar or you're sitting at home on a couch, but it's not an interactive experience. You might have people with you that you're talking to, but the broadcast is not interactive. And there's really no way for you to interact with other people who are not physically with you as you're watching the game. I think many people in esports find that the chat functions, et cetera, that are on platforms like Twitch, where they watch, or YouTube, where they can talk to other viewers at the time and get their reactions, et cetera, that's a big part of it for many people. People also tend to have sort of like viewing parties on Discord, which is another similar platform for it, connecting with other people as they watch games, which is sort of a similar thing to going to bars, except you don't actually have to go out. You don't have to be in the same city or even the same country as some of the other people that you're watching with. The third thing is that, you know, you and I can tweet at LeBron every single day for the rest of our lives. We're never going to hear back. You and I can also tweet at many of the biggest esports stars in the world. And it's actually pretty likely that at some point, we'll get a response if we say something semi-thoughtful. In fact, I would argue that if you say something reasonably thoughtful to many of the more active community members, you actually tend to get responses. And I think people really appreciate the fact that they feel more, they can relate more to people who play, or to esports stars, I guess you could say, people who play games for a living, because they're just more accessible. You know, you see them streaming, you see their cameras, it feels more personal. It's not just the big camera somewhere in the ceiling as you're playing on the court. So I think that's a big difference. And I think that, you know, the whole streaming side, even outside of official competitions, is a big part of why gaming in general has been doing a lot better during coronavirus, because you can kind of do that no matter where you are, from anywhere, from home, and it allows people to stay connected.
Tommy, can I ask again, trying to put some of this into perspective, because there will be a lot of people listening to this that you know, are aware of esports, but really don't understand just how big it's become. You know, I've been reading articles for a couple of years now, and you know, when I started digging into this stuff, it blew my mind just how big this has become. So for you, as someone who was there in the early days of professional esports, can you kind of try and quantify for people who really just have this vague idea of esports as a concept, and many of them will think, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, who wants to watch people playing video games? Can you just talk about the growth of this as an industry and perhaps put it in numerical terms so people can understand just the scale of this thing now?
Also, I think Newzoo, which is sort of the analytics platform that people tend to use and cite when talking about the size of esports, I think they estimated that esports is going to be $1.1 billion in revenue this year, which just gives you some sense. Now, obviously, that's very tiny compared to just about every sports league that exists out there, much less any entire sport. So, you know, it's going to be tiny compared to La Liga, which is still a small piece of football overall. But I think the best way to sort of think about it is you see how it has progressed, as you said. So 10 years ago, you know, you would have some sort of larger scale events, but by and large, you'd have at most, you know, some hundred number of people attending in person viewership before the streaming platforms took off, you'd get to, I don't know, 50,000. Like the peak probably was about 100,000, but really there was no other way, no real way of tuning in. You'd have to have the game to be able to watch, which obviously restricts viewership quite significantly. And then something like 10 years ago, Twitch started taking off, other streaming platforms started taking off, and that really helped fuel the growth. Because all of a sudden, everybody could tune in on their smartphone, tune in on their computer, tune in on their TV, regardless of whether they own the game, and they would just kind of see whether they like it or not. And I think that was one of the things that kind of brought back in many of the people who grew up playing games in their, you know, mid-teens and early 20s that might be now in their 30s and 40s, don't have time to play, but are still interested.
And Tommy, answer me this, as I have a child, I have a son who loves his gaming, so I'm sort of one of those parents that has all of that to contend with. When, because you've played both, so you've done physical sports, you've done gaming, esports, etc. Is there an appreciation, and I think I know the answer to this, but where you played ice hockey or football or whatever sport it may be, one of the things is that you appreciate in real sport, physical sport, is where you see the skills of a footballer versus what happens on the playground. If you're watching the narrative of gaming and it's at a professional level, is it, the physical, or what you're watching on screen, what the viewers are watching, are they marveling at the skill? Clearly there's great digital dexterity. Is it the narrative? What is it that makes it compelling? And I know that many games of football and many sports aren't at all compelling. It's the binary nature of win or loss. But is there something that is special about esports that makes it very compelling on a screen that maybe those who aren't involved don't really understand?
And frankly, ultimately, I think it all just comes down to competition. I think that's what people watch for. They want to see how teams play. And then, you know, there's media not too dissimilar from traditional media like ESPN covering these games that are building the narratives and building the storylines that people want to follow. With that said, you know, it depends quite a bit game by game, even team by team, you know, what the storyline is or what people might be watching in for. So people watch the Lakers and the Hornets for very different reasons. Likewise, you might watch some incredibly skilled teams just purely for their aiming skills and, you know, how, as you put it, like how mechanically skilled they are in the game. And then there's some teams that lack more, as you would put it, quote unquote, skill, but then that are much more tactical. So you might watch them more and think in terms of like a grandmaster chess game where you just see how people are moving their pieces around the map. This is still an FPS game, by the way, just sort of the metaphor I'm using. But it's really mostly about the tactics. There are teams even within the same game that play completely differently. There are teams that sort of just go for the most talented possible roster and they just try to win that way. And then there's teams that just play the right way. So to draw a parallel to the NBA, you could think about the mid-decade Spurs compared to the Heat, for example. One was sort of the superstar collection, and then, you know, while Kawhi turned out to be one of the all-time greats, and I think that sort of skews the view of how the Spurs looked like at the time, they really were a team, and that's how they won, same as the Raptors last year compared to Golden State.
Tommy, I'm going to ask you a question as an ex-rights holder at a governing body. So what I'm hearing you say is this: we're losing the youngsters in terms of participation in real sport. And once we lose them at that age, we're never going to get them back. So I think sport in the last couple of years had a real wake-up call with KSI Logan and this whole idea that you actually have to go where the audiences are and not just hope that you put on a product and that everybody will follow them the way that we all did with our dads and everything. So you're consulting me as a major rights holder, governing body, that my mandate is to grow my sport. And I'm coming to you and I'm saying, Tommy, what do I need to do? You know how these youngsters think. I need to get them onto my playing field. What would you answer me, mate?
Well, I mean, certainly integrating, but really our influencers, say like the KSA logo thing, is one way to do it. It's a way to sort of connect the two audiences. And that's I think one of the reasons that many sports team owners are starting to invest in esports. While that's not exactly the same as sort of involving influencers and getting access to their audiences, it's a similar idea. Ultimately, ultimately, really what that is about is, you know, back in the old days, you would kind of hope that there's someone who grows up and gets built the right way by the media to become the face of the sport. So for, if you think about boxing, you know, when Pacquiao and Floyd were about to retire and were in their old days, you weren't really sure who was going to be the next next big fighter. You just weren't sure who was going to be the next big one to take over. And there really wasn't anybody really in the weight class after Floyd kind of just left as a winner. But in many of these things, you can actually kind of work around it by integrating some of the influencer types. So, you know, for example, some of the big YouTubers whose audiences are just sort of beyond imagination. If you think in traditional terms, the kind of audiences that people can just kind of collect without really being known to the mainstream. There's many people in YouTube that might have 100 million subscribers that even I don't know about, because what they do is just might be adjacent to what I'm interested in and what I'm involved in, but it's not really the same thing. To be honest, I don't think there's any sort of easy fix. I think if there were, someone would have already done it. And I think we'd have sort of fixed sports, if you will. I don't think there's an easy way to do it. What I will say is, to the extent that you can try to integrate sports and get them viewed by the same audience, I think that's a way of at least trying to capture some of those people. But ultimately, I think it just starts at a younger age.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But one thing I don't necessarily fully agree with is I really don't think sports have realized that they've got a problem. You say it would be fixed. I think there's a lot of people in sport that don't realize, if you ask them what the average age of a fan is, they would get nowhere near the 55, 56, 57 number. So I think sport doesn't realize it's got a problem. But regardless of that, I asked you the question and you gave me that answer. I would come back to you and I would say, right, so what you're really saying is I need personalities. I need celebrities. The sport is going to go, like society, much more towards the top end, the people that you can create a character for, a celebrity for, an image for, and the rest of sport will almost become in some way marginal, recreational, amateur. Do you see that polarization in traditional sport, that it's going to become much more about the LeBrons and the Michael Jordans and the Cristiano Ronaldos? Is that where you think the two meet, esport and traditional sport?
I think we've actually already been veering in that direction for a while now, to be honest. I think it probably started with with LeBron changing teams like a decade ago. That was, I think, really the first time that sort of these marquee players started changing teams, and it became about the players for many fans. You know, it's not so much about the Heat, not so much about the Cavs. People care about LeBron. Same way, you know, people were big OKC fans and everybody was unhappy with KD leaving the team. But then it turns out now that everybody's actually just a Kevin Durant fan. It doesn't matter where he plays. It doesn't matter what he does. People care about Kevin Durant. They don't necessarily care about the team as much. And I think that's the big shift that maybe not everybody has caught up to yet, but certainly seems like it's polarizing the world, to be honest.
Tommy, can I just want to take you back, because somewhere along the way, the kind of second half of my question got hijacked, and I'm sitting here fascinating listening to it. But we hadn't got to the part about quantifying the scale of esports. You know, we talked about the beginning of it, that there are, you know, 100 people watching and 50,000 worldwide. But I'm really keen for the audience that don't understand this to understand just how big these esports events are now. So if you can kind of bring us up to date and kind of describe the landscape for us today for esport events, both in person and obviously streaming and stuff on platforms like Twitch.
Sure. So, I mean, the esports is obviously still a little bit different in Asia, in that some of the numbers that you're getting from there, even the numbers that you can trust, that you can kind of verify through photos, are just significantly larger. With that said, you know, I think it was 5 years ago now or 4 years ago now, the first time that they filled Staples, and it sold out in about 5 minutes. So with the big difference, and I think the misconception that people still have, that I think sometimes gives esports too much credit, is that while esports can fill all these big stadiums, you know, fills Barclays, fills Staples, it does that, you know, 20 times a year. It's very different from the Lakers selling out Staples 80 times a year plus. So nowadays it's big enough to get these big events. You know, there's been events in Korea where they have 40,000 people at an outside stadium. The highest viewership number, excluding Asia, which again gets a little bit sketchy, I think sometimes, is for the League of Legends World Championship. They get about 1.5 million viewers concurrent. So again, you know, some of these numbers are not apples to apples compared to sports. You know, you generally view TV broadcasts on an average minute audience basis. Some of these are peak concurrent, et cetera. So it's not always directly comparable, but that gives you an idea. You know, you have million and a half people tuning in at once and continues growing every year.
Tommy, it's Giles here. Fascinating numbers and fascinating because they continue to grow. They're not going anywhere other than up. In a former life, I ran sponsorship for one of the world's larger businesses, I guess. And esports was never on the portfolio, though that may change in all sorts of sectors, as we've seen, say, with BMW's recent announcement in the last few weeks about getting involved. With my old hat on, if you were pitching to me, or to someone who had a budget for sponsorship and support, what is it, do you think, that that sponsors are getting? What is the access that they're getting that is more compelling than maybe traditional, more physical sports? And it's not a challenge. I'm fascinated to know what the pitch is.
I mean, frankly, it's just a demographic that by and large does not exist in traditional sports. You're getting access to a group of people that really isn't there the same way. That's ultimately the answer. The overall pitch, if you're just thinking about, you know, esports versus traditional sports, is very similar. You want to get access to high affinity brands. You're not buying, I mean, you're getting a piece of media, but really if you only want media, you're going to Facebook or Google. They're going to do a better job of that for you. So you want to align your brand with a high affinity brand that consumers really care about. And that's a similar pitch to traditional sports, but the fundamental difference is the age demographics, the number of young people following gaming and esports in general, super, super over indexes compared to traditional sports, where again, you're really getting access to older people and some number of younger people, but it's not a good coverage of all age groups.
Tommy, this I think is again quite fundamental to some of the thinking that is around in the sports industry today, and that's what I keep coming back to because I know what people are chatting about in my industry. And one of the things they're chatting about was Amazon coming in as a major bidder for traditional sports rights, and of course they took a little piece of the Premiership. Tell me if I'm wrong here. I see Amazon investing much more on cloud-based gaming platforms and on Twitch, and I'm not sure that that bothered about traditional sports. I mean, you with your investment banker hat on, and if you were advising Amazon, what would you be saying to them about where to be spending their dollar?
I mean, I don't have the full Amazon strategy or good enough understanding to necessarily speak to it, but I mean, they clearly just want to be a one-stop shop for just about everything you're interested in, almost anywhere. You know, they range from doing proper media now. Amazon Prime, I think, has almost comparable coverage to Netflix, and it certainly looks like they're trending in that direction. I think, obviously, Amazon, you can buy almost everything on. AWS services gets you everything on the internet in terms of hosting. I think the one piece that's missing is live sports. And I think that's the one reason that I think the Netflixes of the world and HBO, et cetera, can never directly compare with linear TV. I think, you know, there's a lot of people like me who pay $100 a month for cable. And the only thing that they watch on TV is actually linear sports. Right now, frankly, you know, there's no NBA on TV. There's no NFL, no hockey, nothing. I don't really know why I'm paying for cable. In fact, I probably should call up AT&T and ask for some kind of discount in the meantime, given that the only thing that's worth paying for isn't on TV. So I think to me, it just seems like they kind of know that if they want to be a one-stop shop for everything online, I think that's the one thing that's missing. And I think that's one way that they could potentially move some of those dollars that consumers are spending on telcos and traditional TV to their wallets. And I think without that, I think you just can't get people off cable. There's still going to be millions and millions and millions of sports fans for a long time who are going to be subscribed for that. And I think if you were able to take at least, not necessarily take traditional sports off linear TV, but at least offer an alternative, I think you'd actually see that many, many more of those people would disappear who are currently subscribing to cable. I think if that happens, there's obviously a snowball effect in that, you know, you start churning out customers. If you're a telco, all of a sudden you can spend less in the future as well. And it becomes this hard thing to stop, I think, as you're rolling downhill. Compare this to Amazon, who has, you know, in this context, endless amount of cash to acquire content. I think they're in a position where they could potentially build up a wall that no one else can frankly come close to. And I think that's a way where they could potentially take on a telcos going forward, I think.
Tommy, you put up an absolutely epic thread on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, talking about trying to explain this to people, and how COVID might move forward the kind of adoption of esports. Can you kind of summarize that thread? I mean, we'll post it. I've posted it, retweeted already, but we'll post it in the Are You Not Entertained Twitter thread so people can see it. But it was, I mean, seriously, one of the best threads I've read about anything in terms of clarity, vision, and a means of explaining something important to people who both understood it and who didn't. Can you kind of paraphrase and summarize that thread for us so we can talk about it?
Sure. So, I mean, there were a couple different points that I made. One was just first going over sort of the apples to oranges comparisons that are just super popular, and kind of explaining why esports are not as big as traditional sports today. In fact, not even close. But because of the growth rates and the trends, I think it's hard to see a world where we go a couple decades where that doesn't slowly start shifting. And the main point that I made, and I'll get to the specifics in a second, is basically that given the trends that have been ongoing for a while and that are actually only increasing in speed, not slowing down, it's really hard to see a world where esports would not overtake traditional sports as we go a couple decades further. So, I mean, the main point really is the age demographic. So today, the average fan of most sports are, you know, somewhere in their 50s, maybe 60s, and has aged probably 5 to 10 years over the last decade plus. You know, extrapolating is a little dangerous. I think everybody's learned that. But if you assume that the trend doesn't completely revert, you go, you know, 3 to 5 decades, and most of these average fans are going to be at life expectancy, particularly keeping in mind that life expectancy today is 80 years, but it's not 80 years for people who, you know, were born 60 years ago. On the other hand, today, every single day, there's new kids being born that play video games. And every one of those kids who's not born in poverty is probably going to play games. Doesn't mean that they're going to watch esports, but they're going to be more likely to. The number of viewers continues growing. The number of players continue growing. I think we're up to about 2.5 billion people who play games today. There's been issues with participation rates in youth sports for, I think, at least a decade now that's been talked about publicly. And if you just continue this trend, more and more kids will start playing games. Fewer of them play sports. Over time, fewer of them will continue watching sports. And until today's 20, 30-year-olds are in their retirement, you basically have a huge tailwind behind esports, simply because until then, you're not going to have all the age groups represented. So you probably have about 4 to 5 decades of growth that's going to be significantly faster than market.
But Tommy, this sounds like the language of we are competing against sport versus gaming. And I absolutely understand the numbers, which are astonishing. And youngsters are playing and it's growing exponentially, which is wonderful. This is a new form of entertainment and competition that couldn't have existed 20 years ago because technology didn't. But are you saying that this means that this is the end of, eventually, physical sports are going to wane and die because of the strength of something which is completely different? What I mean is there is no comparison between me playing football in the park with friends to me gaming with people on FIFA. But the two are very complementary. One is in the park with friends. One might be going to watch at a stadium, a professional team, and one may be in my house playing against people from all over the world. It feels that one of the problems to me within the esport gaming world is there's this parvenu kind of chip of chippiness, which is we have to a feeling that there has to be a destruction of real sport, when actually, and I'm not saying that you're saying it, when actually I think surely the two can work hand in hand.
I would certainly hope that they work hand in hand. I've said this before. I actually watch more traditional sports than I watch esports, despite of my, you know, despite my role and my involvement in esports. I spend more time watching football and hockey and basketball than I do watch esports. So I certainly hope that traditional sports stay around for as long as I'm alive, and hopefully longer. I don't know that they're complementary. But I also don't think that they're a direct replacement. Except in the sense that they're, you know, hours taking up your day. I think the reason that people sort of make these comparisons, generally speaking, is just it's just the easiest way to give context and help other people understand, and sort of just help explain the size of these things. I don't really see any reason that both could not exist. The only problem is, I think from what I've seen, it's usually hard for anything to sort of stay as interesting the second that it starts declining, which I think is the worry in a couple decades. For as long as there's really good players and salaries are going up and everything is exciting, I fully expect there to be viewers. I think that's one of the concerns that people have had over esports, just in terms of valuations in the last couple of years, is if there's ever a point where everything kind of takes a couple of steps back, that's when you sometimes run the risk of things actually sort of crumbling a little bit. But I don't really see any reason why the two could not coexist. In fact, they almost certainly will coexist for at least another half century, very strongly so. I think the reason that they're compared, besides I'm sure some people having a chip on their shoulder over it, is just that it's easier to give context that way and kind of frame the size of the opportunity, I think.
Tommy, all of us on our side of the podcast are parents. I don't know whether you've got kids yourself not yet, but you know, all of us, I think, would look at traditional sport, and that doesn't mean becoming a professional sports player. It means learning a dressing room culture. It means learning about being second or fourth as opposed to winning, and how that changes your personality. It means learning how to work in a team and maybe not be the glamorous person, but still having your role, and at the end of the day, celebrating or commiserating together. The biggest criticism of esport is that it does none of those things. Yes, dexterity, yes, speed of mind, multitasking, all of that. But what is the answer to the criticism that you're taking all that other stuff away? Not you personally.
I don't think today there necessarily is a complete answer. I think some of that you kind of learn if you're playing competitively and not just playing games for fun. Again, you know, there's a pretty big distinction between just logging in and playing by yourself and playing in a team environment competitively. I think over time, and we've already started to see this, more and more of the sort of young level competitive gaming will turn into more organized formats. So again, like you said, one of the benefits of sports is that, you know, it's organized. You play for a coach, you kind of learn how things are supposed to work. You learn to act the right way. You know, you learn to work with a team, et cetera. Sometimes that can be hard if there isn't anybody with authority kind of ruling over. I think that's slowly changing. You know, there's big plans for collegiate and high school and even younger levels of sort of organized competitive gaming that are already taking place in different countries at various speeds. And I think that's going to become popular simply because that's what the parents want. And it's an easier way for them to feel comfortable with what their kids are doing, knowing that they're structured and knowing that they're, you know, getting taught the right way of doing things. And for what it's worth, by the way, I think one of the big problems with many of today's professional esports players is the fact that they didn't play organized sports growing up. So they've never really gotten used to being told by a coach that you just can't act one way. So the classic example actually is that there's a bunch of people who are sort of, might not have the best attitude, but they're incredibly talented. So, you know, you have to find the balance of how much you can let them get away with it just because you want them to stick around because of how good they are. The problem is they might have never played a traditional sport where they have a coach, where if you do something dumb, no matter how good you are, you're at the end of the bench. The problem with many esports game titles is that you don't have substitutes. And, you know, it's partially for a good reason. If you have your five best players in a 5-on-5 game, you want to play them the entire game. if LeBron's playing NBA 2K instead of basketball, he's not going to the bench. He's playing the whole game if he's still the best player in the game. You know, he's not sitting just for the sake of sitting. You don't have that issue in esports. So as a result, you don't really have substitutes, which makes it really hard for you to kind of punish players for acting out.
That, you know, that to me, that's a fascinating thing that I really hadn't thought about. You know, as you kind of look ahead and try and map the landscape for how esports could potentially upend traditional sports, you know, that part of it I hadn't thought about. But when you look at the world we're in now, Tommy, you look at lockdown and the chance that one way or another this is going to be the kind of life we live, maybe intermittently, over the next several years. Do you see this period as an extraordinary opportunity for esports to really get a hold? Or do you think it's something that it won't really materially affect the trajectory of its adoption?
I don't know whether it'll have a material impact or not. I do think that it'll increase the number of gamers. I think that there's going to be more structure put in place earlier, just to get people, you know, kids competing and playing together in an organized way. I think it'll have some impact. I don't know, like, you know, I have no idea how material that'll end up being over the long term. Ultimately, you know, some of the issues that pertain to traditional sports also impact esports. You know, it's not that obviously ticket sales are not as big of a part of esports revenue model as it is for traditional sports, but not being able to do events, not being able to do many of these other things or travel, et cetera, still impacts esports as well. The impact may not be as large, but it's still there. So I would imagine that there's going to be some help. I think on a relative basis, obviously it's easier, but at the same time, I think these things just take a longer time to play out. If we get a vaccine sometime next year and things kind of return to normal, then the impact may be too limited. You know, you're not going to be able to build up, at least I wouldn't think so, a full program for how to play organized gaming and esports, you know, in a couple of months' time. I think it's just going to be a longer time to get all that build up. But I do think that it'll have some impact on the quick, sort of the speed of adoption and how quick some of these things are built up.
Excuse me, Tommy, I've got a question. Again, when you think about many of the sports, the traditional sports, they either started many thousands of years ago and have evolved, or they started around about the 1850s in Victorian Britain. Doesn't really matter. But a lot of them have been going fairly unchanged since then. And that's been the heritage tradition that's been passed down from father and mother to children. And that's how we learn and we socialize, and they become events, and events become on events because people take them. And that's a historical lesson. Again, not being a tech guy at all, with esports, because they are technology, and technology seems to be moving at warp speed anyway, technology today, tomorrow, is already obsolete. How does esports protect itself from creating the tradition when the tradition moves so fast because it's in a technology play?
It's a good question. You know, no one honestly has the answer today, given that the whole thing hasn't been around long enough. You know, we've only really had competitive gaming and computers that could support an internet infrastructure that could support it for about two decades. What I would say is, so far, we've already seen a couple of different game franchises, for example, League of Legends, Counter-Strike, that have been around for long enough. Dota, I guess you could say as well, that I think those franchises seem to have, you know, withstood the test of time, certainly so far. And my best guess is that every, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's gonna be enough updates to sort of modernize the game to whatever the standard is at the time. And I think that's how these are gonna stick around. My guess is that there's gonna be, you know, however many different sort of clearly different game types there will be. I guess you could say there's, you know, MOBAs, FPS games, and different types of, you know, class shooters, etc. I think over time there's probably gonna be a dominant game in each one of them that will last for a much longer time. I think in some of the genres, it's possible that there's more variability and more games, you know, sort of overtake one another, even within the same decade. But I think it certainly seems so far, based on everything we've seen, that many of these genres will just have a dominant game type, even if it's not the same game, that will be, you know, a new version of it. So you think Counter-Strike started off as a game that, you know, was really just a mod on Half-Life in 1999 or 1998. The next version of it was Counter-Strike 1.6, came out in 2003. they announced Counter-Strike Source, I think, in 2005. And then the current version of Counter-Strike came out in 2012. It's not exactly the same game, but it is very similar. I think if you played Counter-Strike back then, you'd watch it today, you'd instantly recognize it. So much like the same way rules changing sports, it looks the same, but many of the details actually are different. So it's not a perfect comparison. And again, you know, many of these things are just fundamentally different. So it's hard to draw perfect comparisons. But I think that's probably how it's going to end up being, with a couple of sort of dominant game franchises by genre. And those just kind of get updated over time to whatever the technology, latest and greatest technology allows them.
Tommy, I want to ask you the last thematic question a little bit from my position as a sport tech investor rather than a rights holder. Myself, I often get approached by people saying, "Oh, I need to get into esports. I need to start, you know, investing in this because it's the future." And I myself have looked at loads and loads of decks, and I never have invested because I can't see where the business is. And what do I mean by that? The first thing I mean by it is exactly what you said before. I'm in the hands of a game publisher, and no matter how I cut it, they're always going to be the dominant player here. And then the teams, the sponsorship of the individual, the events. I, to this day, still can't see anywhere where I would want to invest. But this is your day job these days, coming back to the very start of the podcast. What are the main themes that you think are interesting where people should be putting their dollars for a return in this area?
So there's a couple different ways to think about it. I'll go over how we think about it first and then some of my own thoughts. So, you know, AEG is one of our largest investors at the company I work for. You know, their model, if you think about it, they're the second largest owner of the Lakers. They own the LA Kings. They own the LA Galaxy. They use those high affinity brands to bring people to Staples, which is a decent business. The teams probably are break even, give or take, over a long period of time. Staples makes money. It's a good business. But then the very high margin thing that they have going for them right next door is LA Live. And that's where they make tons of money. The problem is you can't just bring the same number of people to LA Live without having Staples. You use the brands to draw people to Staples Center. And then once they're there in the close vicinity, you get them to LA Live where they go out for drinks and food, et cetera. That's much higher margin. So I think the vertical integration model is how you get the most benefit out of these high affinity brands that by themselves are not necessarily very cash flow positive assets. We kind of view our strategy similarly. So, for example, we own a team called MIBR, which is the largest esports brand in Latin America. We own a platform called Gamers Club, which is if you play Counter-Strike, the primary game that the MIBR team competes in. If you play that game in Latin America, you're playing on Gamers Club because it offers the best service, etc. Now, if you're also a Counter-Strike fan while playing it, you might go and you might want to read about it on whatever is the equivalent of ESPN over there for esports. That happens to be a website called Draft5, which we own, and that is part of the broader Gamers Club network. We've also set up what we're starting to build towards, sort of like a digital RSN called MIBR TV, which is where we broadcast the MIBR games that we have broadcast rights to. So we use the high affinity brand. We do all the things that we can to monetize it directly. We sell sponsorships against it. We do events against it. You know, we get participation fees from various tournaments and leagues. But then we use the team to draw people to the platform where we charge them directly. You know, it's a direct-to-consumer model. They pay monthly subscription fees and one-off microtransaction fees. We charge them directly. We then pull them over to the media platform where we're selling media against advertisements. We get them to come on MIBR TV and watch. And, you know, it's sort of a vertical integrated model. So that's how we think about it as a company. More broadly, I would say that there's a couple different solutions. One, I think game publishers ultimately will always have the best economics because I think it's just the best business together with streaming companies, for example. However, we've already seen today that some of the largest teams that, you know, by now are valued in the hundreds of millions and have significant access to capital and ability to do things have started talking to various smaller game publishers about potentially partnering and launch of new games. So, for example, what if you took the 10 largest esports teams that have the largest brands and most capital, et cetera, and they funded one of the game publishers in their next financing round, that you build something and then all of a sudden you're actually one of the, all the teams own a piece of the game publisher who bring out the next game and they put all their full weight behind the game that comes out, then you actually have a system where you share the economics much more evenly. That's one model that's being thought about. And I think it's slow, it's going to get executed in a in relatively soon. I think the other piece is just that over time, to the extent that the esports model proves itself as something that really, really drives value for these game publishers, I think the economics will have to get redistributed somewhat. What I mean by that is we talked about some of the games that have, you know, stood the test of time, say League of Legends, Dota, Counter-Strike. These are by and large the games where teams have the largest brands. And can drive the most value. And the reason that these games stuck around for two decades is not because they have the best graphics or even necessarily the best gameplay. It's because of the esports side of it that drives people to stick around and watch games, et cetera. And I think that's, I think that drives significant value. And I think that's why many of the game publishers today want to start with the esports integration from day one. So I think that's the other, that's...
Tommy, everything you're seeing in this, is about owning the whole vertical. It's about getting as much of the fans' dollar output as possible through all the ways that they spend their money around their passion, which is a game. Sport, for 2 years, maybe longer, has talked about this blooming direct-to-consumer model, Spotify model, get more of the But that's not where it come from. Sport today is still very much a B2B model. Low risk, you sell your rights to whoever pays the most and you forget about it. Whereas what you've told me, which I agree with, is you need to own the whole ecosystem and you need to squeeze it like a lemon. Well, how do you see... On you go, Tommy.
I was just going to say, I think that's one way of looking at it. And I think that's one approach. But again, as I said, I think to some extent the economics will get redistributed over time. And I also think that as people who watch esports and are fans age, I think there's at some point not everything will be free on Twitch. And I think that's gonna be the fundamental change that changes the economics. I think more broadly for teams is right now, most of the content is just almost effectively gonna be given away for free. I think the more that it grows, the more money that will be paid out for media rights. I mean, frankly, I think that's the biggest missed opportunity for esports to date is many of the games are still given away for free. And it doesn't mean that we're going to put everything behind paywall, you know, in a year or two. But ultimately, there's going to be ways of monetizing that more effectively, whether it's through some of that being behind paywall, some of that being sold to cable, some of that being monetized through microtransactions, et cetera. There's going to be ways of doing that. It's going to bring in significantly more money.
I think, you see, for me, it's going to be fascinating to watch how this happens. Because I think this is going to be the big change for me, is how esports decides that, okay, we've got critical mass now. We can start monetizing. We can start, you know, wringing the last drop of juice out of that lemon, as Roger puts it. And the effect that has on traditional sports in terms of the kind of spend choice of consumers, of parents, of kids is going to be fascinating to watch. And Tommy, hopefully we can get you back on as this evolves, because it's one of those stories that really is in its infancy now, and it's something that we're going to have to really pay attention to. So, you know, on behalf of the three of us and of our audience, you know, thanks for coming on and giving us such a great kind of look at something that really is new to a lot of people. I've been following you on Twitter for some considerable time, and the stuff you put up there is fascinating to me. God, so perhaps bless. You could just give the audience who aren't familiar with you prior to this the ways in which they can kind of follow you and follow your thinking, because it's first rate.
Sure. My Twitter is TOMI Tommy, so that's the easiest way of following everything. Obviously happy to come on a second time. Thanks for having me. Just only wish that I had time to have a little bit more caffeine before getting started. I think I'm still still waking up and starting to gather my thoughts for the day.
Exactly. Tommy, thanks so much.
Thank
and we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Take care.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, gents, I knew it would be interesting. I didn't quite understand.
Need to bring the A game for that one.
It's just fascinating, right, Roger? I mean, yeah. You've been on this for longer than Giles and I. What were your thoughts on all that?
Well, listen, you know, the demographic thing which we touched on a lot, I think is the main thing for sport. The rights fees always going up have made sport, I think, pretty complacent to the fact that they were losing the young fans. And all of us that have got teenage children see that. So I wanted to ask him about that. And I asked him specifically about, you know, how he would advise a rights holder. I don't think we got a real answer because I'm not sure there is one. So it was fascinating to hear somebody answer it from his side of the table. And then we talked obviously about, you know, where the value is in esports and what are the models. And it's incredibly complex. We heard how complex that was when he went through it. That's his profession. He's obviously a mega brain and he can think about how all these synergies work together. And hopefully it's given the listeners a bit of an idea about how I think traditional sport needs to change as well. This old idea of you do a TV deal, you do a sponsorship deal, and then you hit the bar. I think those days are gone. It's long, long gone. And you're going to need the kind of skills that you've heard from somebody like Tommy. These are high-powered skills. And I think that's the real challenge for sport. How does it get the skill set up to the kind of level that we heard on our podcast today?
Well, Charles, you've spent a career interacting with the people that Roger is just describing who are going to have their entire world upended and have to change their skill set, the way they think about things. You know, in your experience, are these people equipped to do that?
Well, I think all of this is fascinating to me because I think there is, as I said during the chat with Tommy, I think the problem has been largely about labelling. I think to confuse sport with esport is action irrelevant. I don't think they're the same thing at all, and they serve different purposes. However, clearly the young and these numbers that he talks about are astonishing as a new form of engagement. And a lot of it is drawn out of influencing and using digital media properly in a way that you attract the young. And undoubtedly, Roger is right that for traditional sports, they're going to have to adopt a lot of the channeling methods in order to engage the young.
Well put.
But, I still believe that for all those kids, and I use a sample size of one of my 17-year-old, 16-year-old son, is that he does both. He loves gaming and he loves cricket. And I don't think that there should be a massive panic that the purity of what sport is, i.e. physical sport, people doing great acts of whatever binary competition, whether it be in a team or individual, will continue to be hugely, hugely the lingua of the world. But in order to make it more compelling from a media point of view and therefore an engagement point of view and therefore a money point of view, starting to adopt new digital techniques that esports have been well ahead of for a long time, it is a requirement that is it has to happen. Otherwise, they'll start, as Roger says, the days of doing a quick sponsorship deal, quick TV deal, and going to the bar. Unfortunately, because I was quite good at it, is over.
We all were.
Yeah, look, I think for me, I don't think traditional sport is going to come under pressure and will cease to exist, but. What concerns me is the amount of spend on that as a pastime, not necessarily in a competitive sense, because you can take a ball down at the park and play with your mates for nothing, but the amount of revenue that esports is going to take out of sports pocket at the worst possible time, when we are going through a period where people are going to cut back on their spending.
I get that. And yet all I can read about, because we're doing this at the time when there is lockdown, so of course esports are absolutely flying because there's nothing else competitive out there. And what is everybody saying all the time? We can't wait for sport to come back. Real sport.
No, of course, because they're missing it. But my point is slightly different to that, in that when the lockdown's lifted, the world is going to be very different, whether you like it or not. We're going to have 15-20% unemployment. And the days of taking your family to a Premier League game, as opposed to spending, you know, $40 on a video game for your son, who's going to get, you know, 1,000 hours of enjoyment out of it. That's my point, is that the esports is going to take away that discretionary spend. And you know, look, sport is, we've all, I think, agreed on the fact that sport is going to have to drastically rethink what it charges, where it pays that money, how players are compensated. All that stuff is going to have to change. And I think esports is potentially another big thorn in the shoe. Well,
and maybe just the catalyst that sport needs, something that I know we want to talk about in future episodes, is something that's been occurring to me for a while, is that this sort of pursuit of globality as the only answer to sport. Every sport wants to be global. Why? Why not focus on your heartland? Why not focus on commercializing what you can do and doing it well? I think this day of reckoning is coming across all sports. We look at the wage bills in some sports. We talk all the things you're saying. It's just got too damn expensive. And maybe, and hopefully, as a purist, as we all are, is that there will be such a shakedown in sport that what we'll start to see is a return to the true values of binary sport, which is ball, team, one team wins, which is what we all love. Yeah.
Well, this bodes well for kabaddi, which they've never managed to make a global sport, sadly, as enjoyable as it is for the neutral to watch. Well, gents, we've reached the end of another fascinating hour and change conversation. All that remains is to thank you, our audience, for listening to us and for following us. Please, as always, like and review and share the podcast with your friends. See if you can help us grow the audience. That would be great. You can follow us on Twitter, should you be so inclined. You're not already. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's A-R-E, the word. You can follow me on Twitter at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
You can follow me at GilesMorgan71 and look out for the next episode, or whatever it's called, the show of the Captain's Table with British Lions Scotland captain Gavin Hastings.
Yes, we should actually, before Roger winds things up, we should actually mention that the most recent Captain's Table with Thomas Bjorn was an absolute bomb. They're getting better every week. So if you haven't listened to that one, then listen in. I mean, Giles manages to find all these guys, and they're obviously all guys you just want to go down the pub and have a beer with, but Giles proves that in spades.
And you can follow me, although I have to warn you, if you're rather sensitive and you don't like bad words... and you don't like insults, do not follow me these days, because I am being targeted by 2.5 million people north of the border. But that's fine; that's part of football. And you can, so if you're the other 2.5, you can follow me at RPM Como, as in the lake, as always.
As in the lake. And by the time we actually edit this and get it out, I would imagine that 2.5 million number is up to about 3.5 million by then. We'll see. Gentlemen, as always, a pleasure, never a chore, and we'll do this again soon.
Great. Wonderful. Fun. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, James. Thanks, guys.